training, and it's a difficult training. And I thought I'd just talk about it for a few minutes. The beginning of Sheni of Emor is all about Psul Mum, that a Kohen who has a blemish, who has a bodily defect, is Psul for the Avodah. I think that's an idea that's a little bit hard for us to understand. Do we really want to maintain such a chitzainistic type of approach? What it seems like, are we going to judge people based on their appearances and say that they should be disqualified for Avodas Hashem because of that? That's a little hard for us to relate to. I mean, it should be hard for us to relate to. I think, you know, we certainly do believe that it's really the pnimios of the person that's important. So we struggle to understand what exactly this idea of Baal Mum is about. Just to mention a connection to a previous Shani from a few weeks ago, so there is a discussion about to what extent do we worry about a Baal Mum for Birchas Kohanim based on this. In general, there's a discussion, is Birchas Kohanim a type of Avoda, or is it something else? We talked about that a little bit when it came up a few weeks ago. So in that context, we basically assume that a Baal Mum is not possible for Birchas Kohanim, but that there was an issue, theoretically, if there was a visible mum on the Kohen's hand, something like that, that theoretically could pose a problem. However, Bizman Hazeh, that the minig is that the Kohen tends to cover himself up with a talis, and people cover up their eyes with a talis, so then we're not so worried about that. But that theoretically, the issue was possibility of a couple things. One possible issue was that it creates a hesech hadas, that the people are going to be distracted by looking at the mum, and that will disrupt their concentration in the context of Birchas Kohanim. So why do we care about that? So let them be distracted, what's the difference? So that was one of the proofs that some Rishonim had along the lines, or that some read into some of the Rishonim, along the lines of the view of the Charedim, that Birchas Kohanim is a mitzvah on the Jews, also on the Yisraelim, not only on the Kohanim have a mitzvah to bless the people, but the people have a mitzvah to be blessed, so they have to be involved also, and we don't want them distracted. So there is an approach that exists like that, which is relevant in that context. That was something which, synergistically, was in a Sheni of a few weeks ago. So this week in our Sheni, so we talk about the Baal Mum soul that does exist for a Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash, and how that challenges a little bit our sense that the emphasis should really be on the primios of a person, not on the chitonius. So on the surface, it's probably the case that, yes, that's true, but that the Kohen and the Kohuna and the Avodas based on Mikdash is a different area of Avodas Hashem that than all the other areas, and it's an area which even Bizman HaMikdash, really only a very small minority of the Jewish population would ever have any connection to. And it seems to be that it's, by its very nature, it is a show, it's a display, and that does have to tailor to a certain extent to human perceptions. So people are looking not so much for the inherent tzidkus of the people involved, that's important too, but that part of what's going on is that there is a external display, and therefore we are very focused on not have anything that distracts from that, not to have anything that takes away from the external display of what's happening. And that we know this is not the only type of Avodas Hashem that exists. We have many other Avodos Hashem, which in some ways are more significant, and Keser Shem Tov and Keser Torah are worth more than the Keser Kahuna. And perhaps in a sense, and I'll take a question in a second, but perhaps in a sense, we find, for example, the Mishnah tells us in Horius that with all the significance that we give to a Kohen, not only does he have to be, and when he's Avodas based on Mikdash involved, so he has to be complete physically, which itself seems a little bit discriminatory, but the whole nature of the kahuna itself is discriminatory in that it only applies based on birth. And nonetheless, the Gemara says that Mamzer Talmud Chacham takes priority, that even a person starts off life with every disadvantage, but he acquires his own status through his learning, so Mamzer Talmud Chacham is in a higher madriga than Kohen. So that would be even less significant if we didn't put any value in the externalities of the Kohen. But because we recognize there's a place for that too, and we still say that on top of that, that Mamzer Tamar Chacham is even holier, is even on a higher Madrega, so that becomes significant, Badavka, because we do recognize that there is a place for all these externalities and singular privileges of birth that apply to the Kohen. So I think Aaron was up first, and then Jonathan.
I mean, you see also the concept of that physicality is important in the halakha concept of Heder Mitzvah, right?
Correct, but the question is what, it's rare that puts a focus on a specific individual. You know, what exactly Heder Mitzvah means? I mean, you're right that there's an interesting discussion you can have about what is Heder Mitzvah about. And if we were learning that sugya, we would start off by asking that question, and I think there are at least two approaches to that question. Heder Mitzvah might be valuable just because it shows greater effort and attention from the one doing the mitzvah, or it might be, which is more what we're connected to here, that we recognize, and all the religions of the world have recognized, that people are impacted by externalities also, and that's why all the major religions have a notion of a very impressive looking synagogue or church or temple or whatever it is in whatever context, that the idea of a house of worship that's going to be very impressive is an idea that's shared by all the religions in the world, and the idea that there's religious artwork and the like, things that are aesthetically pleasing, that idea is co-opted into Kvod Shamayim, so we find that for sure. So it's fair to say that as well. But here it's just a little harder for us to relate to, because when you're dealing with human beings, so we'd like to believe that it's about something else. So again, the truth is it is about something else. We have many other arenas in life for even more valuable accomplishments. But the Beis HaMikdash, the Avodah Beis HaMikdash, happens to have this external element that is built into its very function. Hi.
Is there any implication that if they lost their ability to take part in the Avodah, that the Kohanim would lose all their privileges as Kohanim, like Kibud and things like that?
No, that's not how we assume today. We assume that
Baal Mum
is only an exclusion in the Avodah Beis HaMikdash, but all the other aspects of Kohuna do apply.
Even if they understand what they're doing.
Right. So that's one approach to take to this whole idea. There is also a discussion, I'm not sure how to totally relate to it, but I'll just share it in terms of giving various perspectives. So Rabital Radinsky has an essay about this in his Sefer Avishka Bitzalo, where he wants to suggest, he notes a couple of other issues. He happens to put this together with Sfiras HaOmer, which is in the Parsha as well, not just going on right now, but is a Parsha's Emor topic, just not in this Aliyah. And the Mo'adim in general are a Parshas Emor topic, so in the coming years we'll have a lot more to say in Parshas Emor, but these are not in this Aliyah. But he notes in the context of all of these things together, he talks about Amunah. He has an essay about the necessity for complete Amunah, and in that context he talks about Sfiras HaOmer, about the link between Pesach and Shavuos, how it has to be absolute and you can't miss anything, and why that's so important, and he develops a whole thesis about Emunah. And then he goes on to talk about the role of the Kohen, that the Kohen is supposed to display a certain type of complete reliance on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and completely separated from any other kinds of concerns. And therefore, he notes, as a kasha as far as, that because of the shifts that they had in the Beis HaMikdash, so a Kohen, how much would a Kohen, even if he did work in the Beis HaMikdash, how much would a Kohen ever work in the Beis HaMikdash? 2 days a year? Right, something like that? Or maybe one day out of every 24 weeks, so that's a drop more than 2 days a year? So if that's the case, why do we have Trumas? And I just bumped it. The Maestris and the like, all these systems of supporting the Kohanim and the Levim under the assumption that they need to be supported because they are not available to work. But how much of their time is really taken up in doing these things? So a person couldn't hold down a job if he had to take off 2 days a year to work in the Beis HaMikdash. It's not true today. So what exactly do we mean by that? Why do we have that need? So he develops this whole thesis that essentially the Kohen is meant to represent publicly this complete reliance on HaKadosh Baruch Hu and separation from any other type of physicality, any other type of physical effort, so to speak. So even though, yes, he certainly could be working all the other days of the year, but nonetheless, the din is he's supported as if he is purely connected to God with no other type of connection. And therefore, also, the Kohen who's publicly doing the role in the Beis HaMikdash, so it's crucial to that picture, he wants to suggest, that it be a Kohen who's capable of working at any other job. He's completely physically showing. He's not held back for any physical reason from doing any other parnasa in this world. But nonetheless, instead of that, or at least in this context, instead of that, he is serving in the Beis HaMikdash. That's a part of the whole message that's meant to be conveyed. And that would be compromised if the image was it was a Kohen who was somehow unable to be functioning in other environments, in other contexts. It's possible, it's a thought. Clearly, when we talk about the average person, so we do believe that being involved in hishtadlus and doing what's necessary in order to earn a living and to function is a key element of life. But the Kohen is supposed to operate on a different plane. There's a symbolism involved, and there is a representationalism involved, and that's what he suggests a little bit, that that's what's going on with the Kohen, and that that's what the idea is of Sphira, that this uninterrupted link between Pesach and Shavuos, they have to be completely connected to each other, and Yetzias Mitzrayim and the involvement of God in our lives cannot be in any way unhinged from the process of Kabbalah Satorah. Has an interesting discussion over there, if you want to take a look. It comes up in other contexts, you know, about the mitzvah of sukkah, whether that was practiced in the Midbar or not. You don't think about it so often, but the idea with one of the symbolisms that we have with sukkah is because in the Midbar we were protected in sukkahs, whether it means literal sukkahs or whether it means a nani hakavah. So then do we assume that they also had a mitzvah to do something different sukkahs time? So if that's what's happening all year round. So there's an interesting discussion about that, but the sukkah also represents this type of emunah, this type of taking away everything else and just having that type of connection. So that's what he wants to suggest in the context of the kahuna as well, that this physical perfection, so to speak, is supposed to represent that this is somebody who theoretically would be perfectly capable of doing other types of labor, but his devotion is to a Kodesh Baruch Hu in the context of the Beis HaMikdash. That's a second approach. There's a third approach, it's on the Pardes Yosef, which you could question a little bit. It's a very technical approach, completely technical approach. It's just interesting in terms of synergy. So those of you who were there, I spoke today in the Beis Medrash as part of the Kinyanei Torah series. So it's a 10-minute shmooze about various midos that are listed in the Brice and the Perkei Avos about what's needed for Kinyan Torah. So I spoke about Miyat Chok. And in the context, discussed the range of interpretations that you find in the Mefarshim about what Mi'etzchok means, about this idea of reducing laughter. So there's a whole range of interpretations, whether it means that you should have no laughter at all, or whether it means that you should limit it, it should be controlled. And does Chok mean any laughter, or does it mean something specifically that's kind of out of control? So that's a whole discussion in the Mefarshim. And you find the exact same discussion in terms of the Gemara in Masechus Brachos, where the Gemara says, "Also amalis chok piv ba'olam hazeh," and a person should not give himself over to laughter in this world. You find again the Mefarshim having the exact same discussion. Does that mean they shouldn't laugh at all, or does that mean that it shouldn't be uninhibited, full laughter? And what does chok mean? The exact same discussion in Miyat Chok there, and that Gemara in Brachos, you find the range of Mefarshim. So what in the world has that got to do with this? You'll find out in a second. It's kind of a roundabout connection, but just in the interest of synergy. So one thing I didn't mention, because I didn't have time, is a short discussion, but it could be that that Shiloh, are we interested in eliminating all laughter, or are we interested in just having it more controlled, is already a machlokas in the Gemara, the way Rashi understands it, because the Gemara says in Masechus Nida that Rav Yirmiya was trying to make Rav Zeira laugh. That Rav Yirmiya would intentionally try to do things that would make Rav Zeira laugh, and Rav Zeira resisted. And Rashi explains over there, he basically says the same shot. Rashi says that Rav Zeira understood he was holding back with his laughter because of his interpretation of Asa l'malei schok piv ba'olam hazeh, that one should not give himself over to laughter. And in contrast to Rav Yirmiya, who was also observant of the halacha, but he had a different understanding. He was machmer tvei. He understood it to mean that he shouldn't be laughing at all. Rav Yirmiya was a more humorous type of personality. So it's interesting, and without going too far with this, but just revere me of being identified as someone who did try to provoke people to laugh, apparently. So throughout the Gemara, in different places, including Baba Basra, elsewhere, so you find that Rav Yirmiyah is associated with questions that seem very out there, very, very precise questions, which others didn't take seriously. The Gemara tells us he was thrown out of the Beis Medrash, got brought back into the Beis Medrash.
The 5th degree.
Right, well, the Gemara about the birds, you know, the birds' exact distance hit. Right, so it comes up twice in the
Bible. The second paragraph, the first up, this question. Of the
right.
Right, and later on it says they returned them to him.
Right, so that's an interesting one. This is hard to figure out why he went back in, why he was thrown out. But in general, he's associated with very detailed questions. So he might be relevant here, because the Gemara in Maseches Zvachim, Adav Chavav Man Aleph, so the Gemara talks about how the Kohen has to be Nichnas Kulo into the Ohel Moed. So the question Rav Yirmiyah asks again is, well, what if he had one hair that was sticking out? His whole body was in, but his hair was sticking out. Maybe that should be a problem also of him not being, the Gemara says, this is Rav Zeira, same caring as Rav Yirmiyah asked Rav Zeira. So again, you can see it in the context of the Gemara or not, but here you have Rav Yirmiyah and Rav Zeira again. Rav Yirmiyah is asking, what about if the Kohen has one hair that's sticking out of the Ohel Moed, should that be a problem? So that's a discussion, but the Paradis Yosef in this week's Parsha, so he wanted to draw a parallel from there to here, that if there is a din, that the Kohen has to be completely nichnas into the Ohel Moed, every part of him, so maybe if there's any part missing, so to speak, if there's any kind of deficiency, or if any part of his body is lacking in any way, so maybe that's a deficiency of this din, maybe that's not called entering in completely. Now, it's not necessarily a perfect parallel, because you could say that the difference between something that's not there at all and that's there and that's outside, like this stray hair. So it's an interesting question whether or not that's a proper parallel. But in any event, he draws this comparison that perhaps that's a chisaron in this din. There's any mum in the Kohen, so it's the same question that Rav Yirmiyah is asking. There's some part of the body of the Kohen that's not being brought into the Ohel Moed. We'll also just mention, while we're on the topic here of the woman, and also talking about Sfiras HaOmer and other themes, so one of the women that's discussed in the context of a Kohen, it's also discussed in the context of the Behemos as well, is the Mum of Sarua, which appears here towards the beginning of the Aliyah. And it means, question what it means. It could either mean that one eye is bigger than the other, or maybe it means more than that, that any part is bigger than its partner, so to speak. If one arm is bigger than the other, etc., something is imbalanced. So Rabbi Simon in Imre Baruch in Parshas Amor, he discusses that particular mum, that particular issue of Sarua, and he notes just Al Pi Derech Hashkafa what the message is. And that he suggests that the theme is that we look towards our progress in life, so we look to be balanced in growth, that we want to have shlemus, we want all of our midos to be perfected, but we want them to be perfected in harmony with each other. Which is interesting, actually, if you're talking about physicality, so you have such a discussion in terms of bodybuilding, you know, and exercising. They talk about it's not a good idea for somebody to exercise one arm more than the other arm. He's going to have one hugely muscled arm and the other one very weak. So he's better off not doing it in the first place. He'd rather have two arms that are of equal strength rather than have one that's worked out in a visibly disproportionate way. So too, when it comes to the less obvious midos, it's true as well that we want to try to, nobody's perfect, but we want to try to grow in a balanced way so that our midos are in proportion to each other and that people don't look at us and say, oh, he's so great at this, and nothing else counts. Everything else is covered up by that and could perhaps be a failing. So that's an interesting issue, and it's relevant also to the period of Sfiras HaOmer, that when we look towards Kabbalah Satorah, we focus on these midos throughout, and it's relevant also to that Chabur that we have every day here about the different Kinyani Torah Midos, that we're recognizing that this is not one thing, that we're looking to fill all the Midos in parallel to each other, and that's a crucial part of Kabbalah Satorah to be a proper experience. Rav Schechter often cites that Rabbi Shaul Salanter was asked, I think in reference to the Talmidim in general, perhaps the question was focused specifically towards Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, who was one of his top three students, who mentioned him in the past. He was the author of the Shailos and Tshuvos for Yitzchak, who was a tremendous gaon. Rabbi Shaul Salanter himself was a tremendous gaon in learning, a traditional Iloi, and was well known for his work in Musar and founding the Musar movement. So he had a number of Talmidim, but a few that really stood out as famous ones, and even among those three, probably the most famous, especially in both realms, was Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, who authored the Shailos and Tshuvos Pri Yitzchak, so he was very successful as a traditional Talmud Chacham Posek, and also authored a Sefer of Musar called Koch Yitzchak. So he was very much a Talmud Muvak in both senses of the word, of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And whether the question was about him or about the Talmidim in general, Sir Shechter relates that the question was asked of Rabbi Yisrael, why do you have talented students who are good at learning, why do you waste their time with the Musar? In general, we know there was a whole dispute between the Musar yeshivas and the non-Musar yeshivas. So these guys, it's not fair, they could end up being great gedolim in learning, and you're distracting them, diverting them from their Talmudic studies by introducing other materials. They're not going to be as great gedolim as they could have been if you hadn't been involved with them in the first place. So Rabbi Yisrael would point to a halacha and Hochos Lecha Mishnah, that we know that for Lecha Mishnah we need to have two shleimim, we need to have two full rolls of bread. So what would happen if you have to choose? You have one roll that is much bigger and more mohudr, let's say. It's a nice big roll, but it's missing something. And you have a smaller roll, and much smaller, it doesn't have the same kind of impact, but it's complete. So we still want to have the smaller rolls. Discussion in the Gemara. So he says, we go, azlinon basar shleimus, not basar gadlus. So what are we looking for in life? It's not so much that we're looking for gadlus, we're looking for shleimus. We'd rather have people who are complete and balanced in their midos than people who are outstanding gedolim but don't necessarily have all the midos in balance. So that was the point that he would make, and it's perhaps relevant to this as well in terms of looking at these mumim, again, they're difficult for us to relate to, but similar to the lessons that we've had for the past couple of parshios in general, we talk about the Beis HaMikdash and the Karbanos and the like, especially Bizman HaZeh, when we're not practicing these concepts, we relate to these ideas more on a hashgafic level. What is the message that's being included? And perhaps that's a part of the message of Saruah as well. Just mention one more point, maybe before moving to Parshas Kedoshim for a few minutes. You also find this aliyah gets into the concepts of truma, which you won't get into so much, but that's important stuff. But also you find the concept of everyone who ever tried starting daf yomi knows this discussion. Because if you get up to the bottom of Beis Amud Aleph and no further, so maybe you're scared off by this discussion, at the bottom of Beis Amud Aleph and Maseches Brachos, it goes over the top of Beis Amud Beis, is talking about this pasuk here of Vo HaShemesh V'Toher, that Kohen, who becomes Tar, so part of the process, the purification process, is that he needs Harav Shemesh, that after he's done everything he has to do and he's gone to the mikveh, he still needs a new day to start. And that topic, again, it kind of scares people off at Daf Yomi. It's a little bit not what they're looking for when they're learning Hilchos Kriya Shema. They think, okay, we'll start off easy, we'll learn Brachos, it's easy, Masechta, the first Daf. Already they got to deal with Harav Shemesh and Tar of a Kohen, what's going on? So some people get a little bit scared off by that and don't get any further. So the Eglei Tal, the Abinezer, talks about this in his Hakdama to the Eglei Tal. He talks about why Chazal put that there, why it is that Maseches Brachos talks about Kriya Shema, why is it that this is a topic that shows up at Daf Beis Amud Aleph and Brachos. And he says that what's derived from here is this idea that apparently a day is influenced by how it starts off. That if a day started off Betuma, so even if everything has happened in order for this Kohen to become Tar, it's still not going to start till the next day. That the day that started off Betuma is going to be defined as a day of Tuma, even if he's finished otherwise his purification process. The day is going to be defined by how it starts. And therefore he has to wait till the next day in order to start with Taras. He says that's also the symbolism why we start off Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema is essentially the first mitzvah that happens, if you do it exactly b'zman, it's the first mitzvah that happens of a new day, as soon as it becomes a new halachic day, if you assume, if you assume a couple things for this to be true, if you assume that z'man shchiva is identical with laila, and you do it at the exact moment, put a couple parts, places into, put a couple of parts into place, so then you start off your day with this declaration of emunah, and that's what sets the pattern for that day. So that's what the Eglei Tal, the Abinezer suggested, that Chazal wanted us to see these dinim together, that this concept of Harav Shemesh as a requirement for Tara has something in common that reflects upon what exactly is the message of Kriya Shema at the beginning of the day. Okay, so those are some things. If you have a few minutes left before we'll go to Mincha, so maybe just to try to squeeze in one or two other issues from the Sheni of Kedoshim, because got to fit it in somewhere. So, okay, so we spoke a lot of Lashon Hara already. Okay, we can speak Lashon Hara for many more hours, but we'll just try to get a little bit further. Let's say if we could look at the next two Psukim. Won't be able to finish all those either. But just to highlight some of the ideas in the next two psukim, that right after that Lashon Hara, so far in Sheni Kedoshim we've gotten two psukim in. So if we can get more, another two psukim. So essentially the next pasuk says, V'lo sisna sa'achicha b'vavecha, ho'chef t'ochiach esamisecha v'lo yisisa olav chet. So there is a halacha that one is not allowed to hate other people, certainly other Jews, that there is a prohibition of the sinah shebelev, and there is a whole discussion what that means, sinah shebelev, what exactly does that play out to practically. It's not 100% clear, and some of them unfortunately emphasize that the focus is specifically belev, that somebody who acts all nice but harbors an inner hatred, that's not right, and it has to be dealt with. It should be something that you should confront the person, if there is perhaps a linkage between the two halves of the pasuk, that it should be read as one idea. That one should not walk around with this hidden anger and this grudge that he's bearing against other people, but he should come out with it. He should say to his friend, listen, I have an issue with what you did, I'm upset about something, and I want to talk about it so that hopefully you'll be able to deal with it. It's an interesting spin. It's not the way we normally perceive this pasuk of Tochacha as being specifically a Ben Adam L'Chavero issue. It's usually quoted in the context of Averis Ben Adam L'Makom. But it's interesting that according to this pshat, which you find in Rishonim, that it's a notion specifically in the context of Ben Adam L'Chavero and the issues that you have had with a certain person, so you shouldn't harbor this inner hatred, but instead you should deal with it, you should say, let's talk about it. So that's a good question, what exactly the issue of Sinah is. There is a suggestion, a little bit of a clue you can get from the Gemara Maseches Nedarim. The Mishnah Nedarim talks about the concept of undoing a neder with a Pesach or Charata. That you can, if you're a Chacham whose job it is to nullify someone's neder, so you need to have some ground, some basis. So there are different kinds, Pesach and Charata, but they involve basically finding some type of weakness in the initial commitment that the person didn't realize it would have this consequence, he didn't realize that this would be true. So the Gemara says, one of the examples you'll say to somebody, and Gemara says, you know that you're going to be violating Kibbut Av Ve'Em with this neder, questions like that. So the Gemara says, did you know that you'll be violating Leisisnes Achicha B'Lavecha? So it's not clear from the Gemara what the issue is, how you're going to violate Leisisnes with the neder. So the Rishonim have different theories. Some say that the issue is, that's talking about the standard neder that you often find, the neder of Hana from somebody. You say, I'm not going to benefit from something or somebody. So if you say you're not going to have anything to do with this guy, you're not going to benefit from him, that itself maybe is an expression of sinah, and that's what the Gemara is talking about. Others say that it's not that, it's something more specific. You say you're not going to talk to somebody, you're not going to say hello to somebody, that maybe there is some specific expression of harchaka. That's how some of the portion have it, that a sinah is a harchaka belayed, person distances the other person. So maybe it's some other manifestation, such as refusing to say hello to the person, refusing to be involved with them at all. Maybe that's what we're talking about. So it's not 100% clear what it is. It's also a whole discussion that we find that Lo Sisna becomes a little bit complicated, because sometimes the Gemara sounds like Sinna is okay. It sounds like from the Gemara that if the person is an Avarian, that Sinna is okay. But that's probably not the bottom line. The Balatanya has a famous passage in Parak Lamed Beis where he suggests, this idea is in the Rishonim already, that there is a distinction between real sinna and the more external sinna, which sometimes in English and in other cultures is translated as hate the sin but not the sinner. It's very possible that that's the idea here as well, that any sinna that you find in connection to an Avera is really to have a distaste for the Avera, but that it shouldn't extend to the person itself. And they explain, Tosfos and Psachim, it has to be explained based on this, because the Pasuk says in the context of Tinu Afrika, that if you have somebody who's struggling with their baggage on their animal, putting it on, taking it off, so the Torah uses in that context the word Sonecha, somebody, it sounds like somebody who hates you, somebody who you hate. As some unfortunately point out, maybe it means somebody who hates you. Maybe that's the issue, but it sounds like it means you hate somebody. So you find it in there that you should help that person first. If you have a choice, you have two people who are both struggling, one who you hate and one who you don't, so you should help the person who you hate first. So why should you do that? It's a very fascinating idea with tremendous implications in terms of all kinds of priorities, because doing so will help you hate them less, will help challenge that sinna, that because you're serving them, it's a little bit of a counterintuitive idea, except that so many psychologists have told us this is true, that you think that you love people who do things for you, but you actually love people even more when you do things for them, when you take care of people, so you develop a greater fondness for them. And therefore, the person who you don't like, better that you should help them first, because through helping them, that will go against this feeling of sinna that you have. So the Gemara in Pesachim discusses, sinna, it's an aveira. How can it be somebody you hate? So the Gemara suggests that maybe it's a person who's a bala aveira. You hate them for justified klapishmai reasons because of their aveiras. So then, Tosfos notes, so then you have an interesting thing here. So what's mutter to hate them, but you should do this in order to stop your hatred of them. So which is it? Is it good or is it bad? So it seems to be that we have to have the split. I think Tosfos has the phrase that you don't want to come to a sinna gemura. So what does that sinna gemura mean? They explain, based on Baal HaTanya, so Zechosha talks about this, that to have some type of external rejection of the Aveira, that's appropriate, but that shouldn't go to the person himself. You should actually hate the individual. And since sometimes people can't draw the line so well, and they do cross over into a distaste for the individual themselves, so that's what the Gemara and the Torah, the way the Gemara is reading it, is addressing, that we have to try to keep that in check and continue to help such people and to engage in chesed. In general, anyway, the whole notion of there being a permissible sinna for somebody who's an avarian, so many, many mafarshim, this is not a radical idea that's a minority view, but many, many major poskim have understood that that's not something that's nogeya b'zman hazeh, that a person to be worthy of such type of distaste has to be somebody who's really intentionally sinning lahachis, and that we don't have that b'zman hazeh. It's evocative of what the Chazon Ish said in a different context. The Chazon Ish, again, is not a liberal Chazon Ish, but the Chazon Ish talking about apikorsis, it says that we don't have such a concept as manazah, because the idea of an apikoros is somebody who saw, he talks about the bayasheni, saw miracles in his mind of bayasheni, and was still able to deny the whole thing, so that's a person who's really kofer, who's really valid. But manazah, nobody has that kind of access to any such blatant proof of God's hashgafa, so anybody who denies it is not coming from the same kind of place. And so too, you find in terms of the status of Russia, whatever it means, that many assume, many big poskim, and that Chazon Ish was of course huge, but many, many other big poskim understood that this is not really something that's relevant today. We don't really have that status today. The Meshech Chachma has a kind of extreme version of this, because ever since Chet HaEgel, we're not on the Madrig anymore to be able to judge people. That's going very far back. But even not going that far back, so many say that Bezman Hazeh, we don't have the right to see anybody in this way. And it's also, again, relevant to one of the many ideas that connect, as we mentioned the last week, this parsha is full of these joint couplets, these two different concepts in each pasuk, so often there's a connection between the two, so that there's a connection between Sisna and Tokcha, that the definition of a Rasha, some of the Mefarshim and some of the Rishonim explain, is somebody who rejects Tokcha. And you give him Tokcha, and he says, I don't care, I'm going to do the Aveira anyway. So it may not be possible to have such a status anymore, because it sounds like from the Gemara, and the Gemara says nowadays, meaning then-a-days, so all the more so nowadays, we don't know anybody who's able to effectively give tochacha. Tochacha takes a certain special touch, and we're not able to pull it off, we're not able to effectively do this, and therefore that's something that we're lacking, that's something that's missing. And tochacha is essentially impossible. So if we can't effectively do tochacha, so then we can't give anyone the status of a rasha, because the rasha has to be somebody who rejected valid tochacha, and nobody's capable of administering valid tochacha b'zman hazeh. I think we mentioned a few weeks ago in a different context the interesting pshat that Bakshi Daron has in his tshuvas, that he talks about the fact that you find somewhat of a stira in the Gemara, that the Gemara says that in the context of tochacha, kishem shemitzvah lomar davar hanishma, kach mitzvah lo lomar davar she'enu nishma. Just like it's a mitzvah to say something that will be heard, so it's also a mitzvah not to say something that won't be heard. And also, the Gemara says that you should give tochacha even up to 100 times. So it seems like it's a stira. If you have to say it 100 times, it sounds like it wasn't heard the first 99 times. So what does that mean? That you shouldn't say something that's not going to be received, but you should give tochacha even up to 100 times. So he suggested that what it means is that the style of tochacha you should be able to convey, the approach that you should take, is one that it's so well received by the person, it's going to be accepted in such a nice manner that even if you were to say the same thing 100 times, it would still be well received. That's the type of style you should bring to the tochacha process. So we're not so capable of doing that nowadays. So we try, if we're able to have an influence in an effective way, so then we try to give tochacha when it's going to be well received. But we recognize the fact that it's a skill that we seem to have lost. And some of the mefarshim explain that in order to really effectively give tochacha, you have to have a genuine feeling of complete identification with the other person. That you completely feel connected and really caring about their well-being so much so that it's possible for you to effectively connect with them. And our mission should be to give tochacha, not so much that we want to give tochacha, but that to rise to that madrega, that we should be able to be on the level where we really can effectively give this message. That's something that we strive for. We strive to try to be in such a place where we'll have that connection, and then we can figure out what we'll do with it. But the first step is to get to that connection in order to be able to convey tochacha. When there is a chiyuv, there's a whole discussion, so if a person really can have an impact, the Maram Shik has a couple tshuvas about this, based on the Ramah, that do we assume that if you could make a difference and you don't, are you included in the Aveira the person did? There is some basis for that in the Gemara. And we know in the topic of Ben Adam L'Chavero, the famous Kamsa Bar Kamsa Gemara, that the whole issue was exacerbated because the Chachamim were there, v'lo muchaveh, that the Chachamim were present and they didn't make any kind of mocha, they didn't make a protest, so you have to know exactly when you're capable of having an impact or not. As it's pointed out in the Rishonim, that really we have two goals with tocha. Sometimes the goal is that you want to change the person's behavior, that would always be nice, but sometimes, even if it's not possible to change the behavior, there are contexts where it's necessary to make a macha, where it becomes clear that even if we can't change it, but we have to, if you represent the Torah, you represent the leadership, so the Torah has to take a stand. So that sometimes has a role, even if it's not going to be effective in terms of the sinner himself, but it'll establish the view that the Torah, so to speak, takes. However, nowadays, even that's complicated, because nowadays, a little bit, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, that in order to properly represent the Torah, you have to have that perception in the eyes of people. And that point itself has gotten so diluted and obfuscated that it's crucial, before you're going to try to engage in such a macha, you should make sure that you're not going to look like somebody who's just screaming with no purpose, but somebody who genuinely has the moral authority that your macha is worthwhile. Otherwise, not going to have much of an impact, even in the other sense of the word, regardless of whether it's going to change the behavior of the person. So, as mine is that, it's a serious question whether either function of tochacha we're able to perform, but that's itself something that really shifts from circumstance to circumstance. And this day, lo sisa lav chait, so we said that we have to talk about halbanos pnei chaver barabim a little bit in the context of Hazav before the semester ends. But one of the prohibitions, well, there are at least two prohibitions in the Torah of embarrassing people in public, and one of them is from this pasuk, because the Gemara says in Maseches Erechin that we're in the middle of Erechin, we have all the sugyas of Lashon Hara and all the sugyas of Tochacha, right? They're together in the middle of Maseches Erechin. So the Gemara says you should give Tochacha to somebody even if you're not going to, so you should give Tochacha. Somebody says the Gemara, Yachol, Afilu Yishtan Eponav, so you might think that I should do this, even if as a consequence of giving the Tochacha, the person's face is going to change color, they're going to become embarrassed. So says the Gemara, no, but I see so of chayt. You see the pasuk ends off that you should not bear iniquity, you should not get an avera because of him, which could mean a few things. It could be related to what we mentioned a minute ago, that you will bear an avera because you failed to stop an avera with tochacha. Well, that's one possible way to read it. But the Gemara also applies in this context that there's a way to do tochacha that will be an avera, that you're going to create a humiliation for the person, you're going to make them embarrassed, so that itself will be a Havera of Ben Adam Havera of Havanos Pnei Havera Barabim, and that's wrong. So the Rambam, when he writes in Sefer HaMitzvah, so he interprets this the way you often find, that there are some mitzvahs in the Torah that are conveyed to us through an extreme context, that you know that if it's true here, it's for sure true everywhere else. So here the case is, you might think this is a justified humiliation. I'm embarrassing the person because they have a mitzvah in the Torah of Tochacha. It's necessary in order to set him straight. So therefore it's justified. So the Torah says, even in that context, so you know from there that when you don't have that justification, where it's just down, you want to embarrass somebody, so then for sure you have a prohibition to embarrass people. That's a style that you find often in the Torah. And the Rambam writes it in this context specifically, but that's what the pasuk means. It's a way of telling you there's a general prohibition of embarrassing people. And the Torah tells us that even when you think you have a good reason, it's still a problem. But that's tells us more about everything else. That's assuming the person's not doing an ongoing avera to somebody else. As the chapter has noted many times recently, if the person is being ma'agin his wife, something like that, he's causing tremendous tzar to another person in an ongoing way. So then sometimes you need to embarrass them in order for the torture to stop, in order for the process to come to an end. That's a different level of tochacha. That's not the tochacha in the context that we're talking about here, but that's a more active kind of sense. So that's basically got us to one part. Do you have a question?
Is there any other heterim needed, let's say, for chinuch versus for their own kids?
There are theoretically heterim. The Rambam certainly does talk about that for purposes of chinuch. I'll tell you that I think it's highly not recommended. That maybe once upon a time there was a context where one could effectively educate through embarrassing. Bizman Hazeh would maintain that it's almost impossible, and that everyone would agree that if it's not going to be a toelis for the purposes of chinuch, it's just going to be in the sort of avodas pnei chaver barabim. So if you could successfully educate this way, there may be what to talk about. But nowadays, the way it's perceived, understandably, is that a person, if a Rebbe is going to embarrass a Talmud, is going to create such a harchaka, it's going to create such a
and even with your own person.
The kids also, the kids will get very upset too. The kids are not going to appreciate this, and they're going to, there are times where it's not going to be necessary, you know, if you're running out in the middle of the street, but it's not going to be overall productive for chinuch, so I would not recommend it, even if theoretically there is such a basis. We did one pasuk, so maybe on Sunday, like I said, we'll talk about it. Oh no, maybe we'll do one more pasuk.